the recording, and we're on our way. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another in our legal ethics series. This is approved for 1.5 credit hours of specifically professionalism credits by the Law Society of Ontario. Many of you have already messaged me with your names in the chat. Please, if you haven't yet done that, please make sure to do so, because without that, I can't record you as present, especially if you're hiding behind the black box with your name on it on the Zoom. Thank you to the Bayit for their willingness to host this shiur, to host the session. I look forward to the day when we will actually be able to have the sessions there in person, but thank you for publicizing it. I also want to thank the following two families who made donations to our Day of Giving back in July and through that dedicated the session, Alana and Jonathan Aziza and Annie and Naftali Winter. So thank you very much. Let's see. Also, a few other notes before we get started. First, I mentioned needing people to sign in if they want to get credit, and that's certainly important. But also, if you want to be on the email list to receive notes about future legal ethics classes, make sure that you sign in. In the event that you've received the email for this session, I don't need you to send me your email address because it means that I have it. However, if you did not receive the email for this session, then when you send me your name, send me your email address as well, please. And then finally, before we get started, this is a bit of an awkward announcement, nonetheless. There is a family in the Toronto area who are involved in a family law case, and they are looking for somebody for pro bono work, and they asked me if I would spread that information. If there's anybody in family law who would be interested, please contact me, and I can make that connection. Our topic this morning is supporting the emotionally unstable client. One other note before we actually launch into this, and that is, as a general rule, I much prefer if people interrupt me with questions and comments aloud as opposed to writing them in the chat. This way I don't need to worry about monitoring the chat as well. There are enough things to do on a Zoom to keep me busy, so if you have a question, if you have a comment, you know, just say so. You can do the raise hand thing if you feel like being polite. But I prefer that over writing the messages in the chat. And then finally, I much prefer giving a session with, you know, while being able to see people. I recognize that not everybody wants to be visible on a Zoom at 9:30 in the morning on a Sunday. I get it. Nonetheless, it's a lot easier for me in presenting a session if I could actually see the people I'm talking to. So if you are comfortable being visible, then please do turn on video so that this is more of a conversation and less of a monologue. Thank you. All right. Again, our topic is supporting the emotionally unstable client. So right off the bat, you have to define what unstable means here, or what emotionally unstable means here. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I do see that we have some on the Zoom who may wish to clarify and correct me on any points of order, and I welcome that absolutely, much as I welcome it when the lawyers correct me on points of law. But I'm trying to work with a sort of pragmatic, practical definition here. And so I'm making a rough distinction, which I will make, and then I will walk back. The rough distinction is to suggest that there are mental illnesses which are cognitive, that affect primarily a person's intellectual function. And then there are also mental illnesses which are affective, which affect primarily a person's mood, depression, anxiety. Now, naturally, illnesses may manifest both, either by their very nature or as a side effect. Some forms of dementia will be examples of that. Schizophrenia will be examples of that. But my point in giving that kind of distinction here is to say that I want to focus on a case in which a client clearly has cognitive function, understands, responds appropriately to questions, is able to appreciate the consequences of their actions, but at the same time, they have an affective disorder. They're experiencing deep depression. They have anxiety. Something along those lines is what I'm going for in this case. Before we proceed further, is that part of it clear? Or does anyone want to comment on that? Because that in of itself, I recognize, is not straightforward. Nope, we're good with that. Okay. Then we'll proceed. So the law society criteria that we're going to address in discussing this are selected to deal with professionalism issues rather than substantive ones. So if you take a look on the sheet, and I put the link for it in the chat a few times, I'm going to put the link for it in the chat once more because people keep on joining. Hang on 1 second. Okay. So we're dealing with recognizing and being sensitive to client circumstances, special needs, and intellectual capacity. We're dealing with the issue of managing difficult clients. And we're dealing with optional and mandatory withdrawal from representation. And those are going to come up in the context of the following vignettes. And we're going to go through the vignettes now at the outset. And then, obviously, again, with each case, then we'll really discuss them. But here's vignette number one. Sarah, a criminal defense lawyer, is retained to represent Jack, a wealthy heir who is charged with selling cocaine near a high school. In their first meeting, Jack confides to Sarah that he has been clinically diagnosed with bipolar disorder, a mental health condition involving extreme mood swings. In ensuing weeks, Jack is largely uncooperative, at times uncommunicative, at times surly, at times outrageously unrealistic in his expectations for the outcome of his case. Sarah begins to wonder whether she could argue that Jack is incapable of participating in his own defense, according to the Huang Hengveld indicators, and we'll come back to those, obviously. Could this strategy of saying that he is incapable of participating in his own defense be effective? And if it is effective, then what's going to happen next? That's going to be item number one. Then number two. Let's say Jack is found to have capacity, and Sarah continues to represent him. Sarah wants to be supportive of Jack during his legal proceedings, but after a few weeks, she begins to notice that he is speaking to her more as a close friend than as legal counsel. One day, he invites her to dinner to celebrate the 2-month, quote, anniversary of their first meeting. How should Sarah navigate the need to support Jack in his unstable state and the need to preserve appropriate boundaries? And then third, Jack's stretches of uncooperative conduct are making Sarah's job extremely stressful. In addition, the strain of supporting Jack while maintaining appropriate professional boundaries is wearing on Sarah. After 1 year of working as Jack's counsel and just 3 weeks before trial, Sarah decides she can't continue. May Sarah withdraw from representation based on the stress of representing Jack? So again, we're not answering these questions right off the bat. They're questions that we're going to have to address in the course of the conversation, but I mentioned them at the outset to explain the three areas that we want to look at: the issue of capacity, the issue of support versus boundaries, and I recognize it's not necessarily versus, but we'll talk about that, and finally, the issue of withdrawal from representation. Everyone good with where we're going? Everyone follows what we're doing? Okay. Then we move into capacity. Now, the truth of the matter is that the capacity conversation is more substantive than it is professionalism, right? Usually the line between the two is that substantive is what's the law on something, and professionalism is how do you conduct your practice. So the issue of capacity really fits more in terms of what the law is. Nonetheless, I think you have to include it, even briefly, in the conversation, and it's going to be more than briefly, honestly. First of all, because going back to our professionalism topics, one of them is recognizing and being sensitive to client circumstances, special needs, and so on, and I think it you know, one of the first questions a lawyer has to ask herself in a case like this is, does my client have capacity? So it does affect professionalism, but also because I don't think you can go anywhere in this conversation unless you first discuss the question of how we define capacity. So going back to our opening question, the question that we asked in vignette number one, we said that he's largely uncooperative. And the question that Sarah starts to wonder is he incapable of participating in his own defense? So I will ask you the question. As a general principle, without diagnosing Jack, because we don't really know Jack, and I haven't given you enough information to really feel like you know Jack, but let's say in general, could emotional instability be grounds for arguing that somebody lacks capacity for litigation purposes? Right. In terms of the procedure, we're going to talk about what the procedure would be for evaluation. That's an important question. But I'm asking, like, knowing a little bit about how capacity works, what would you think? So I saw Gary raise his hand, and I didn't see Mrs. Whitty has raised her hand. So I'm going to take Gary because I saw him first, and then Mrs. Whitty. Yeah. Gary, you have to unmute. You're muted, Gary. Yes.
I'm used to using the iPad, but I have to go to a laptop.
Okay.
As to how you can properly get instructions from a client like this, waiver, back and forth, and that would be a major concern here.
Okay. So the issue of how is this going to work, even if he has a comprehension of what's going on, is he going to be able to cooperate with you in a meaningful way? That's what I'm understanding?
Yes.
Okay. Good point. Mrs. Whitty.
So when you talked about capacity to participate in his defense, there's capacity to instruct counsel, and then there's the decision as to whether they are capable of testifying, and they're not really the same question.
Could you flesh out that distinction between capacity to instruct the lawyer and capacity to testify? What do you mean by that?
Okay, you're talking about a criminal situation.
Yeah.
And, okay, capacity to instruct counsel, my understanding of it is you can get a capacity assessment done and have a professional tell you that, yes, this person understands that they are involved in a lawsuit, they know who their lawyer is, they know basically job of their lawyer, the other lawyer, the judge, the other parties. They understand litigation and they understand the decision-making process. And as you said, the person's cognitive abilities weren't really in question here. So what's in question is, are they capable of making a decision and understanding the long-term consequences of that decision from, you know, from an emotional point of view? They might say, no, I don't want to go ahead with it. And then tomorrow say, no, I do want to go ahead with it. Obviously, I deal with civil litigation. The capacity to testify in their own defense on a criminal matter might be a little bit more complicated. And, you know, in the end, it's a little bit more of the lawyer's judgment as to whether this person's testimony is going to be helpful to their case or not, because they can decide not to testify.
Right. And that's less an issue of capacity and more a question of, is this a good idea? All right, so we're going to go a little bit towards that at some point because we have to discuss where the problem is not that they don't comprehend, the problem is not that they lack capacity, but the problem is that it's bad for them. So we'll have to talk about that. Moish, you've got your hand up. So one of the points that we're going to come back to with the judge's observation regarding a case involving family law where one of the participants was under extreme stress and it was very bad for her to be involved with the litigation at all. And the judge said, well, that's what we see every day in family law, basically, that the stress is awful for the people who are involved. So we're going to have to talk about that. All right, let's go through and discuss this based on the statutes and based on the Law Society's own rules. Well, Law Society is less relevant on this in particular, but in any case, we're gonna discuss this in terms of what the law has to say. I will note that somebody emailed me the other day regarding this topic, saying we also need to discuss supporting the emotionally unstable lawyer. To which I responded, absolutely, but that's really its own session. that's just not going to fit in this conversation. Okay, so generally speaking, if I understand the law correctly, intellectual incapacity seems to be the standard, not emotional instability. So that if you take a look at source number 3, I brought you a couple of paragraphs from the Substitute Decisions Act. A person is incapable of managing property if the person is not able to understand information that is relevant to making a decision in the management of his or her property, or is not able to appreciate the reasonably foreseeable consequences of a decision or lack of decision. Okay? They need to be able to understand information that relates to making a decision regarding this is a property line. So it's about property specifically, or not able to appreciate the consequences of a decision or lack of a decision. We're going to come back to that and flesh out a little bit more, but I just wanted to show you a second paragraph from the Substitute Decisions Act. A person is incapable of personal care, right? We're moving from property to personal care. If the person is not able to understand information that is relevant to making a decision concerning his or her own health care, nutrition, shelter, clothing, hygiene, or safety, or is not able to appreciate the reasonably foreseeable consequences of a decision or lack of decision. So it's the same format. It's, can you understand the information that relates to the decisions you're taking? And can you appreciate the potential consequences of those decisions? And that's what we're talking about here. I brought you in source number 4 a little bit more of a definition, and this comes from the website of the Attorney General of Ontario, where we're told, the Substitute Decisions Act 1992 applies an understand and appreciate test of incapacity. Understand refers to the ability to understand information that is relevant to making a decision, while appreciate refers to the ability to appreciate the reasonably foreseeable consequences of a decision or lack of decision. Failure to understand or appreciate is grounds to conclude incapacity. A person who lacks the ability to understand is one who lacks the factual knowledge base and skills needed to manage the decision-making demands of their circumstances and cannot be educated in that regard, or lacks the ability to intellectually understand the options for meeting their financial or personal care needs, or cannot communicate their choice or decisions. This is a very intellectual definition. It's about what you know, what you don't know, what you understand, what you can foresee, and what you can't. As it continues on the next slide, a person who lacks the ability to appreciate is one who lacks the ability to realistically appraise the risk and likely outcome of a decision or lack of decision, lacks the ability to plan and to take action to implement the plan, or lacks the ability to rationally manipulate information to reach a reasoned decision consistent with personal values and free from delusional beliefs. You have to be in touch with reality. This is from the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee, who, going back to Michael's question about who takes care of this, may be the ones getting involved through the Capacity Assessment Office. So this is all relatively broad. But if you take a look in source number 5 on the sheet, this comes from a recent case, Carmichael versus GlaxoSmithKline, but it's a quote of a standard established earlier. We get a little bit of a finer definition of what this actually looks like via what are called the Hwang-Hengveld indicators of capacity. So the case involving Carmichael, I'm going to mention it because it's actually going to come back again later on, is a case in which the argument is that that Carmichael did not pursue action against GlaxoSmithKline before the limitation period ran out. And Carmichael argues that that was because of incapacity, and therefore the litigation period didn't start, the clock on the litigation period, on the limitation did not actually start running because of incapacity. So as part of the decision, we get these indicators of capacity. There are 7 of them. Please take a look in source number 5. I'm just going to mute everybody by default, just because I'm getting some background noise. But again, as always, you know, unmute to ask questions and make comments. So looking at the criteria in number 5, a person's ability to know or understand the minimum choices or decisions required to make them. Okay? Have to know what the choices are. An appreciation of the consequences and effects of his or her choices or decisions. An appreciation of the nature of the proceeding. I don't really know what that means, and I haven't been able to find out. Does anybody know what appreciation of the nature of the proceeding means? Do they have to know that it's litigation? What does that mean? I have 49 Zoom windows here, so someone ought to know, or if not, I'm not responsible to know. Because if all of you don't know, then I'm good. The nature of the proceeding. I don't know what that means, and I haven't been able to find out. The others are much more clear. A person's ability to choose... Yes, Gary.
A person has to understand what's going on. That's basically what it means.
And that didn't come into A and B? Knowing and understanding the choices and decisions, the consequences and effects. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time, you know, something was redundant in law, but okay.
Well, they might also need to know whether they're dealing with money or with a criminal matter where they could go to jail.
Okay, I hear that. A person's ability to choose and keep counsel. A person's ability to represent himself or herself. A person's ability to distinguish between relevant and irrelevant issues, and a person's mistaken beliefs regarding the law or court procedures.
If I could just interject.
Please.
And offer a possible meaning, it's what is being decided.
Mm-hmm. And that isn't under appreciation. Okay, I mean, I would think that's under consequences and effects of their decisions, but I hear you.
It's their own decision. That one is their own decision.
Okay. So these criteria are the criteria which flesh out for us what capacity is. Is anything in here related to emotional stability? Can you tie any of this to emotional stability, the criteria that are listed in source number 5? I can think of one. Item D, right? A person's ability to keep counsel. It could be that emotional instability is going to so damage their relationship with counsel that they can't keep them. And in fact, I saw that in one of the cases where the judge let counsel withdraw just because of the frustration of trying to work with the client. So that could happen. Take a look at number 6. This is a family law case, Constantino v. Constantino. This is just brought here as an illustration. The test.
By the way, just to jump in, F as well, it is actually very, very common, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
People get all emotional and they bring in and complicate, you know, what actually the main issues are as opposed to what the complicated issues
I hear.
Are.
Yeah, and you're tying that to emotional instability.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear that. Okay. If you look at number 6 from Constantino v. Constantino, the test for appointment of a litigation guardian, we have to talk about litigation guardians in a bit, is a functional one. It relates to the incapacity of the litigant generally to manage his property as defined in the Substitute Decisions Act to the issues that must be decided in the particular litigation. The incapacity of the litigant has to relate to the issues that are being discussed. And the test in this is the same in this respect as that set out in Rule 7 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. The person must appear to be mentally incapable with respect to an issue in the case, and as a result of being mentally incapable, the person requires legal representation to be appointed by the court. For the appointment of a litigation guardian to be appropriate, the cause of incapacity must stem from a source of mental incapacity. The emphasis there, the bold, italics, and underline is not mine. That's in the original. Such as mental illness, dementia, developmental delay, physical injury, not from a non-legal capacity-related reason, such as lack of sophistication, education, or cultural differences. Additionally, the incapacity so caused must affect the litigant's decision-making in relation to the issues in the litigation. So there's nothing here that directly speaks to emotional instability. The person who comprehends but feels incredible anxiety. It seems like the rule here is that actions are key regardless of their cause. Meaning, if their emotional instability causes them to act in ways that don't demonstrate understanding and appreciation, if they have the cognitive ability, but because they are emotionally unstable, therefore they act in ways that don't demonstrate understanding and appreciation, then indeed they lack capacity. But otherwise not. I'll give you an example of what I mean. If you take a look at source number 7 from that same family law case of Constantino v. Constantino, the question is whether this fellow, Mr. Constantino, has capacity. And as you see in paragraph 59 in source 7, he suffers from paranoid schizophrenia, and that as a result of his mental illness, he is incapable of instructing counsel or making the decisions that the present proceeding requires of him. How do you know that he's not capable of instructing counsel? He has demonstrated a pattern of conduct over the past 5 years characterized by the following. He demonstrated an inability to know or understand the minimum choices or decisions required and to make them. For example, he submitted in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary that Ms. Constantino had no need for a restraining order against him and resisted providing his capacity assessment to his lawyer in the face of a court order that he do so. He demonstrated a lack of appreciation of the consequences and effects of his choices or decisions, including his prolonged refusal to communicate with his lawyer, or to respond to Ms. Constantino's offer to settle, or to permit his medical treatment providers or family members to give necessary information to his lawyer. He demonstrated a lack of appreciation of the nature of the proceedings and its requirements by failing repeatedly to attend court. If you see what I'm saying here. They're not saying that he lacks capacity because of his paranoid schizophrenia. They're saying that because it manifests in ways which demonstrate lack of understanding and appreciation, therefore, he lacks capacity. You see the distinction? It's very interesting. One question that I saw that came up for me, and I emailed a couple of lawyers about this, and was not able to get a definitive answer, but I think this is an important question before we discuss what happens if a person indeed lacks capacity. What if they fully understand and appreciate? They pass those tests. However, the stress of litigation would be dangerous for them due to their emotional instability. Do they lack capacity or not? They understand, they appreciate, but it's bad for them, like dangerously bad for them, to participate in the litigation.
How do we know that?
So let's say their psychologist tells you that. the psychologist, you know, files a report saying that. So take a look at Evans v. Evans in source number 8. And this goes back to the point that I made before about family law. Family law litigation can be an emotionally charged environment that can cause significant stress on litigants and those involved in the process. Litigation touches on intimate and personal issues that go to the fiber of individuals' emotional and physical well-being. The results in a family law trial have serious impact on people's lives, including financial well-being and relationships with children. The impact of family court decisions on lives of litigants cannot be overstated, and certainly, since the stakes are high, it is not surprising that litigants can find the whole process daunting, which can make them anxious, stressed, depressed, and worried. Litigants can be immersed in fear and become very anxious as they await the final outcome. Now applying it to Mrs. Evans. There is no question that Mrs. Evans is a stressed litigant. The medical evidence of her practitioner clearly sets out the mental health history. Most importantly, the independent medical report filed by an expert, which has not been contradicted, demonstrate that Mrs. Evans is at a point that she is so stressed regarding the litigation that to proceed with the process could cause her emotional damage to her mental health. And when you read the actual decision, they bring you numerous filings from mental health experts who had interviewed Mrs. Evans, who all concur on this point. However, the report does not address the issue of whether she can make decisions regarding the issues and instruct counsel. The report does not specifically deal with the factors suggested by Justice Price and Constantino, The report does not discuss the above, nor provide any conclusion regarding the above factors, meaning the Hengeveld factors. A litigant who has significant mental health issues that result in an overly distraught individual who is anxious about the trial process is indeed a troubling issue. However, at this point, the court is not satisfied that a litigation guardian should be appointed in this case. As far as Evans v. Evans is concerned, we feel really bad for her. We understand that participating is dangerous for her, but she's capable. That's the decision of the judge. Which makes sense, given everything that we've already read. Yes, Miriam. What's it, Miriam and then Dawn.
Just a quick question. The litigation guardian...
I don't hear you suddenly.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Is a litigation guardian someone who will stand in place of the person and make all decisions for them?
So, more or less, yes, but I'm going to come back to that with greater explanation in a minute. My next step is to discuss, so what happens if someone lacks capacity, and we'll talk about what the options are, litigation guardian being one of them. Yeah. Dawn.
Yeah. I have a question. So let's say a person has a real bona fide serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia or bipolar, and if their medical report indicated that they would likely commit suicide if they were continuing. So
I don't think it would be different. I don't know what happens in that case, but the reports by the doctors who interviewed Mrs. Evans were basically at that point, to one extent or another, but some of them explicitly so.
That's unfortunate.
And that's what the judge says. That's exactly what the judge says. It's a troubling issue. Next, that's what the judge says. But that's what you see there. I did see something that misled me for a little while until I came to a better understanding of it in the Carmichael case. The Carmichael case, which I explained before, was a limitations issue. And in order to understand what was done in Carmichael, you have to first read the Limitations Act in source number 9, where it talks about incapable persons. The limitation period does not run during any time in which the person with the claim is incapable of commencing a proceeding in respect of the claim because of his or her physical, mental, or psychological condition. Okay? So keep that in mind as you read source number 10, the judge's decision in Carmichael, where again, the Carmichael's statement was that his limitation period should not have started because he was incapable of proceeding. So a physical condition is a condition arising in or relating to a person's body. A mental condition is a condition affecting or arising in a person's mind and includes mental disability, mental incompetency, or mental illness. And a psychological condition is a condition relating to the mental or emotional state of a person. Okay. I mean, the judge is having trouble because the wording of the statute is awkward. Physical versus mental versus psychological. As is evident from these definitions, in many cases, there may be no clear demarcation between a psychological condition and a mental condition. What exactly did you mean when you said psychological versus when you said mental? And they go on with that point, finally saying in paragraph 102, lastly, I agree with the submission in Mr. Carmichael's factum that a plaintiff may be incapable because of a psychological condition where the evidence, quote, is clear that initiating the lawsuit would pose an unacceptable risk to the plaintiff's psychological integrity. He's able to say, it would have been dangerous for me to do this, therefore, I was incapable of proceeding. So I, as a layperson, read that and said, oh, that means that if it's dangerous for me, I lack capacity. But it's not true, right? Because all that they're doing here is based on the language in number 9 of who is capable and incapable of pursuing litigation in terms of the limitation period not starting. It doesn't mean a person lacks capacity. It means they can't be expected to have pursued litigation. And it's legitimate to say it would have been dangerous for me to pursue litigation, therefore don't start my limitation period, without that meaning that he lacked capacity. You follow? They're not saying that you lack capacity in that circumstance. That's what it seems. So what happens in such a case? In the event that there is instability to the point that it really does lack capacity, where do you go with that? So as we've already said, the norm is for there to be a capacity assessment. That's what's supposed to happen. The Office of, what was it called again? I forget. The Public Guardian Trustee is the general office, but they have something called the Capacity Assessment Office. But you're right, they're the overall. That will conduct the capacity assessment, although, interestingly, in the Carmichael decision, they say the judge may play a role in this. The judge in Carmichael, in source number 11, says, the Huang-Hengeveld criteria that we read before, while not exhaustive, provide helpful indicators of capacity, concrete, objectively verifiable indicators of a potential litigant's capacity to commence an action. If you don't have it, that tends to support a finding that the person was incapable. But, goes on to say, these factors are neither necessary nor sufficient in themselves to establish incapacity. They are indicia that guide a holistic weighing of all the evidence on capacity in the context of the case, depending on the circumstances. It may also be relevant for a court to consider other factors. So the court is going to play a role in this evaluation. What happens if the decision really is they lack capacity? So it depends. If they don't know the wishes of the litigant, then it's considered best to get a litigation guardian. In the event that they know the wishes of the litigant, then you could go with Section 3 counsel, who is a lawyer appointed by the court to represent the incapacitated person. That distinction between where we know the wishes or don't know the wishes is based in source number 12, Dawson v. Dawson. I came to this via an article on the Hull & Hull website, so I want to thank Ian Hull. But if you take a look at source number 12, many lawyers appointed pursuant to Section 3, the ones who are representing an incapacitated person, do commendable work in difficult circumstances. They make a tremendous effort to discern their client's wishes, often provide the court with very helpful insight as a result. If they're unable to understand what a client wants, however, a Section 3 lawyer cannot make decisions on that person's behalf. By contrast, a litigation guardian stands in the shoes of someone under disability. As the PGT acknowledges, the Office of the public guardian and trustee, acknowledges in its submissions a litigation guardian does not take instructions from persons under disability, but makes substitute decisions in their best interests. And then it goes on with that. Okay. We've spent 40 minutes talking through the general legal framework for this. It's about time that we get to something Jewish. So, like in the civil system, I'm getting an education here without having to pay for law school, so that's nice. But like in the civil system, we have standards in Jewish law for intellectual and cognitive incapacity, which actually mirror aspects of what we saw in Ontario's rules. So we talked about ability to appreciate, right? To appreciate what's going on, to appreciate the consequences of one's actions. So the classic passage in the Talmud on incapacity is in the beginning of a volume called Chagiga. But I chose, rather than bring you the Gemara itself, the Talmud itself on this, I wanted to show you the decision in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. We'll come back to the passage from the Talmud later. Take a look at source number 13, please, from Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in Tzfat in the 16th century. And he says, I'm reading my English translation, but you can see the original Hebrew there as well. A bunch of people just lost their screens. They lost their videos. The more you can keep it on, the better off I am when I'm speaking. So if you can, great. If not, understood. A shote, okay, shote is a term that really defies clear translation into English. Some suggest it's someone who is psychotic, but it doesn't really fit. It isn't always somebody who is psychotic. It is somebody who has been declared insane, but that's not a definition. That's just a legal category. Shote equals insane. It's not what the word means. There is a lack of rationality, but what does that mean? So take a look at source number 13. A shote is disqualified from testifying in court. This is not only a shoteh who wanders around without clothing, breaks implements, and throws stones, which are the Talmud's criteria, but anyone whose mind is torn, so that his mind is confused perpetually on some matter, even though he speaks and inquires on point in other areas. He is disqualified and considered a shoteh. If the mind is torn, and torn is a literal translation, nitrifa da'ato, his mind is torn so that he's confused perpetually in some area. So this sounds like failure to understand and appreciate is really where what it sounds like to me. That is fleshed out in source number 14. Rabbi Yeshua Falk, in his commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, adds a category which Maimonides discussed before him. Those who are confused and hasty in their minds are also disqualified. And those who are especially foolish, what does that mean? It appears that the meaning of all of these is that they are not patient in their affairs. They perform all of their deeds hastily, not understanding the end of the matter and goal of the act. Therefore, this is also considered foolishness and irrationality. One more definition of this that's brought, and then I want to look at this as a whole. It appears that we have no one more confused and hasty than a person who is struck with powerful fever. He is a shote, biblically disqualified. What we've seen so far here in these sources, I see your hand, Miriam, hang on one second. What we see here in these sources, does this speak to a specific category, emotional versus intellectual? It is all over the place. Why? Because it's about actions. It's not about underlying causes. Even a fever can be the underlying cause. If you act in a way that demonstrates lack of understanding and appreciation, then lack capacity. Miriam, you were going to say? That's a really good question. Fortunately, I can say no. First of all, it's important to recognize that the halachic system that we're talking about here does not disqualify women from testifying across the board. A great range of cases, classes of cases, absolutely allow for men and women to testify. There are particular sets of cases in which it is true that testimony is limited to males, and it's a great topic for another time, but it's really not one that's going to fit right here. But it's never suggested that it's a function of lack of capacity. I think in the Muslim system, you actually find a statement about women being very sensitive and easily influenced and therefore potentially lacking capacity. You don't find an analogous statement in Jewish texts. You don't find it in the Gemara, you don't find it in the Rambam, you don't find it in the Shulchan Aruch. So they don't make that equation. It's a technical disqualification for particular areas, but it's not a lack of capacity, or they wouldn't be accepted as witnesses in the cases where they can testify. Yeah, that's what I would say. But no, it's not disrespectful to ask that at all. We're good. So in terms of what you're seeing here, it's a very action-based disqualification. I actually stopped short in the sources. Take a look at number 16, please. Maimonides mentions another category, which was already referenced in 14, but Maimonides was an earlier source for it. He says, those who are especially foolish, petty is the term in Hebrew, who do not recognize contradictory statements, do not understand matters as other normal people do. Also, those who are confused and hasty in their minds, those who are especially foolish, are in the category of the shoteh. It is as the judge sees it. One cannot specify a mindset in writing. If you manifest an ability to understand, to appreciate consequences, you're in. If you don't, then not. Then you lack capacity. I should note here, the sources I've just brought are about testimony. However, they extend beyond ability to testify. I just ran out of patience with putting things on a source sheet when I hit like 7 pages. But the Code of Jewish Law, Choshen Mishpat 96.5, Sarivav Hey, talks about the idea that someone who's in this category is not able to lodge a claim against other parties, is not able to swear an oath in court. Later on in also Choshen Mishpat, it's Kuf Peched Bet 188.2, we're told that somebody who lacks capacity is not able to assign a proxy to take care of things. Instead, their rabbinical court may need to assign what's called in Greek/Hebrew/Aramaic an apotropos, in English a litigation guardian, where you're dealing with litigation. But what about emotional instability? So Jewish law seems to rule that emotional instability in itself is not grounds for declaring incapacity. Meaning, the person who is emotionally unstable may well be considered capable unless the instability is affecting their actions. And this has fascinating practical ramifications, some cases for leniency, some cases for stringency. So here I bring you in source number 18, the classic source from the Talmud for dealing with issues of, the definition of insanity, really. I already referred to this before. Who is a shoteh? Who qualifies for this category? So we've already seen what you're about to see in the Talmud quoted in the Code of Jewish Law. One who travels alone at night. One who sleeps in a cemetery. One who tears his clothing. Those are your criteria. Rav Huna, one of the sages, said, one who displays all of these at once. You have to have all three. If you only have one, nah. Rabbi Yochanan said, even one of these behaviors is sufficient. Anybody here travel alone at night? It happens. So, you may have a problem. So the Talmud says, wait, what is the case? If he acts apparently irrationally, meaning, if he's traveling alone at night, meaning he goes running around on the street at night with no purpose in a dangerous area, then even one of these behaviors should suffice to label him irrational. Just the fact that he does that. If he does not act irrationally, meaning if there's an explanation for each thing that this person is doing, then even all of them would not suffice. Then do all three, you're still not irrational. No. This is where he acts apparently irrationally, but one could explain each symptom in a rational way. And I skipped it here, but the Talmud brings justifications for each of these activities. So, example, an important example we're going to come back to, wandering alone at night, the Gemara says, maybe he has been gripped by something called gandripus. Gandripus, according to some commentators, is anxiety. It's based on da'aga. It's based on worry. And that causes him to say, I just need to go for a walk. And he goes out, even though it's at night. So you could explain why he's acting in the way he's acting without resorting to saying this person is irrational. So the Talmud says, if he's acting apparently irrationally, but you could offer an explanation, but he does all three, then I'm going to assume that this person is, in fact, a shote. This person is irrational, where I don't know my justifications are legitimate. I just have theories about why they might be justified. Maimonides says, you have to recognize the criteria you're seeing here in source number 18 are not specific. They're meant as examples. And so he says, what we've already seen in the Code of Jewish Law, number 13, I brought it again in number 19, he says, it's not only the shoteh who wanders around without clothing, who breaks his stuff. It's as long as the person is confused perpetually. That's it. But it's an action-based system. It doesn't matter what the cause is, intellectual or emotional. Miriam.
Are we going with an assumption that no one wants to be considered a shoteh, that we don't
good.
Have to?
Good. So this is a really good question, and that's exactly where I'm going with this. I mentioned before that this could have leniencies or it could result in stringencies in Jewish law. And here is the case in which this becomes most relevant. Some of you may be familiar with this case. The case is known as the get from cleav. Get, bill of divorce in Jewish law. But rather than write out a whole explanation of it, I went to a website that discusses some of the nuances of the case and just lifted it from there. So take a look at source number 20. This is a classic, classic case. And really much of, it was a watershed moment in terms of modern Jewish literature dealing with emotional instability and mental health. Unfortunately, it took a case like this to get a lot of writers to put thoughts in writing about this sort of thing. Not many divorce cases have earned a special name or deserve to be assiduously detailed in halachic literature. One outstanding case, though, was that of Yitzhak Nierberg and Leah Gunzhausen of Germany, who were divorced very soon after their marriage, about 200 years ago, 8th of Elul, 5526. Okay, so now we're talking about a little bit longer, call it 250 years ago. The couple wed in Mannheim, but the bill of divorce was delivered in Cleve and has been since known as the Cleve Get. Immediately after the wedding, the young husband became very introverted and sometimes murmured incomprehensible statements. On the Shabbos of the Sheva Brachos week, okay, the week after the wedding, he took the dowry of 24 gold karolin and absconded to a neighboring village, and when discovered, explained that he had to desecrate the Shabbos and flee because all his limbs trembled and a deathly fear had befallen him. He says, I had to run away with the dowry. For some reason, the bride's family did not yet demand a get. They didn't say, this guy better divorce her. After the next Shabbos, Nierberg, the guy, was in Bonn, where he summoned his wife's relative, Rabbi Shimon Copenhagen, and told him he was in great danger and had to leave the country immediately. The husband said, I am in danger, I have to get out of town. There was no Beis Din, no rabbinical court in Bonn, so the wife's family continued to cleave on the Dutch border, as Nierberg intended to flee to England via Holland. Hagon Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz, the rabbi of Cleve, the grandfather of the author of Tiferes Yisrael on the Mishnah, arranged the divorce, Once the husband insisted, he would be condemned to death unless he fled to England. He said, I have to run, I have to flee, I have to get out. So they said, all right, let's have the bill of divorce. The couple's financial matters were then settled, and Leah returned home. So far, while it's a terrible situation, she's divorced and that's it. On hearing the news, Nyerberg's father, the guy's father, became incensed, especially about the financial settlement, which he deemed unfavorable to his son. He appealed to the rabbis of Mannheim and Frankfurt am Main to disqualify the get, claiming his son was insane and therefore halachically unable to divorce. The rabbis of Frankfurt and Mannheim soon issued a long and elaborately explained decision disqualifying the get and consequently defining Leah as still married. Her family appealed to other leading rabbinical authorities. The stormy discussion echoed throughout the halachic community to the point where every prominent expert voiced his opinion. The entire rabbinic roster of Europe 250 years ago weighs in on this case. And now, Miriam, you follow that claiming insanity can be in the best interests or in the worst interests. It all depends on which way, on which side of the case you're on, right? The woman wants to say he was sane, and therefore the get is valid. The husband's family wants to say that he was insane, and therefore it's not valid. So the same standard that we've been applying shows up in the decisions regarding this case. To say it's not about anxiety itself. In this case, it seems to be some kind of anxiety disorder. There was no substance to his claim that he was being pursued. The anxiety in and of itself is insufficient. He has to perform acts that demonstrate that he is not rational in order to be declared insane. And on that basis, the get was accepted by Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, the Node of Yehuda, one of the premier authorities of the day. If you take a look at source number 21, Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Farbstein, who is the Rosh Hashiva of the Chevron and Yeshiva in Israel, wrote a very important work on capacity in Jewish law called Mishpatei Hadat. And in his discussion of the case of the Cleves get, he says the following. Rabbi Yoshua Heschel Levav, in his responsum on the Cleves get, in which the divorcing husband fled his home on Shabbat due to baseless fear, and in his other affairs he was rational, ruled that he was not considered a shoteh. And so he wrote, if he acted as a shoteh, and we could ascribe it to fear or black bile, what is black bile a reference to? Sorry? Dr. Saffer is muted. Nope, not a plague. So the four humors.
Depression, here you go.
Yeah.
Is depression.
Precisely. The four humors are a theory going all the way back to Hippocrates and seconded by Galen. And within this idea, you have the fluids in the body, which when they are out of whack, when they are in balance, can cause disorders. And black bile is associated with depression. In Hebrew, it's called marash chora. So, he says, in number 21, if he acted as a shoteh, and we could ascribe it to fear or black bile, he would not have the status of a shoteh. We would not call him irrational. If we could assume what he was dealing with was depression, and that's what made him do this, then we would not call him insane, because we would understand his thought process. Nonetheless, certainly, at a certain level of fear, there is interference with his function, which renders him as a shoteh, even according to Rabbi Yoshua Heschel of Lvov. So let me make sure that I'm saying this clearly, because I think this is actually a really, really important statement. He says, emotional instability does not make a person incapacitated, because it gives us a logical way to explain why he's doing what he's doing. As long as his actions are not inexplicable, we're willing to accept it. This idea that depression is not making somebody incapacitated shows up in a modern work. Source number 22, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau was a major, major authority on all issues related to Beit Din, all issues related to financial law in Israel, until he passed away about 5 years ago. And in his work, Petrei Choshen, he writes, source number 22, in defining a shoteh, we have found in Chagiga, that's the source in the Talmud that we quoted, various signs via which it is recognized that he is a shoteh. And some later authorities indicate that as long as one's mind is not settled and he does not control his deeds, even if it is due to depression or black bile, he is in the category of a shoteh, at least for financial matters. If the mind is not settled and you don't control your deeds, then even if it's due to depression or black bile, the person is a shoteh. In other words, what he's saying, to make it more clear, fits with the last line in source number 21, is that you can reach a point where it's too far. Emotional instability in and of itself does not disqualify him, but if you reach a point where the behavior demonstrates irrationality, then the person will indeed be a shoteh. It sounds very similar to what we saw in those decisions in civil and criminal law. It's all about what you're doing, what your actions are, not about where they come from. Miriam. Yes.
He was determined to be a shoteh at that point. A week earlier, he must have been a shoteh too and couldn't have entered into a marriage.
And that's one of the legal arguments that's brought in that whole discussion about the get, is was this something new, or is this potentially something that was going on already from before? So you are 100% right. That comes into the conversation as well.
It's a little soon to be new. Like, this is right away.
You'd have to consult a mental health expert to really be able to say that. I don't know how they would look at the stress of the marriage itself and its potential to be a watershed moment. But that diagnosis is far beyond me, certainly. Not to mention, we don't know them. We don't know what was going on. But yes, that is one of the legal arguments that is made in the literature. I should note, just to give a little bit of background, two paths that lead to this conclusion that it's action-based within Judaism. So if you take a look at source number 23, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, points out the Gandripus discussion that we mentioned before, although in his manuscript is called Angripus. We said that if a person is walking around alone at night, that may not demonstrate that he's not rational. He could have this illness called Gandripus. So Rabbi Sofer makes the point, which I brought here in number 23, he says, we are saying that this person could have depression. This person could have anxiety, however you explain what Gandripus is, and yet we're not calling this person incapacitated. As long as he understands and responds, he does not lack capacity. That's one argument here. A second argument is that if you look back in Chagiga itself, go back to source number 18. We mentioned the symptoms. Traveling alone at night, sleeping in a cemetery, and tearing clothing. So now take a look at source number 24. Rabbi Farbstein quotes Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, quoting Rabbi Chaim of Brisk, major authority in Jewish law from the beginning of the 20th century. Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky cited Rabbi Chaim of Brisk, saying that according to Rambam's view, not only the manifestations mentioned in the Talmud are signs of mental illness, but every illness could have different manifestations, meaning there are many more potential symptoms of mental illness. That was what Maimonides said in the source that we brought in number 16. But these signs define different mental illnesses, and from them one could learn the types of illnesses which were established as defining a sufferer as a shoteh. He says, when you look at the symptoms in the Talmud, you could understand which illnesses might lead the person to being called a shoteh. One who sleeps in a cemetery, one who goes out alone at night, describes the illness of black bile, the illness of depression, he argued. Sleeping in the cemetery, going around alone at night, he thinks may be connected to depression. One who tears his clothing describes one who suffers from the illness which causes destructive behavior and inability to control one's mood. Rabbi Farbstein interjects, apparently mania, and so on. He's not a psychologist, although he did a lot of research, but he writes apparently mania. But the point is that what you're seeing here is the person may have these illnesses, but it's really about how they are manifest, just like in the secular system. Now, I'm going to come back to the question I asked about the secular system. What if participating in litigation would pose a threat to them? The secular system did not seem sympathetic. What about within Jewish law? So, other than we did say, to be fair, that the limitation period may not start. So there was that level of sympathy. But the within Jewish law, it's way beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss today. I gave you a link in source number 25 to a session I gave on mental health in which I talked more about recognition of mental health and instability and threats to one's health. So you could catch that recording and get more information. But basically, you do have a recognition in Jewish law that emotional instability can threaten somebody's health, and it may well exempt the person from having to face the rabbinical court, but it's not going to be a matter of incapacity. It's going to be a matter of the other party being told you don't have the right to endanger this person's health by pursuing them in court right now. It's a religious statement. It's not a legal statement. So what happens in Jewish law if somebody is declared incapable? So we don't have an independent capacity board, although contemporary rabbis do often consult doctors for diagnoses on these things. But fundamentally, what will happen is an evaluation which requires the rabbinical court to use its seichel, to just, yeah, you have to look at what's in front of you. So I brought you one source on this from Rabbi Moshe Sofer, in which he said, judging in the matter of shotim is impossible other than through the eyes of a judge who understands its nature. One cannot clarify in writing the nature of the shoteh. As Maimonides wrote, the judge only has what his eyes see. In other words, don't look for a written definition of what is a shoteh. That's impossible for us to give you. You're going to have to you're going to have to evaluate it. The rabbinical court is going to be responsible to consult experts and evaluate. We can't give you something in writing, and that's been consistent down through the ages in Jewish legal literature. What if the person really isn't capable? Then what do? So much like the options that you see in the secular system, they could appoint a proxy before they became incapable. That's one option. Family is able to act on their behalf. There's a lot of literature on that, but family is able to step in with the assumption that the patient is going to accept them acting on behalf of the patient. Or the courts can appoint an apotropos to be their guardian. The apotropos's job is to stand outside of the person, but in that person's place. I will note the one area in which Jewish law will vary from secular law in this regard. And that will conclude this piece of the discussion before we move on to the boundaries issue. And that is that Jewish law generally expects the court to intervene to help someone who is viewed as needing additional support in order to balance the playing field. Now, this is tricky because by intervening, you could potentially convince the other guy that the court is no longer fair and unbiased. This can create a problem. But take a look at source number 28, where Maimonides, as part of a discussion of who qualifies as a judge, gives you the mission of a rabbinical court. The Hebrew is lahatzil ashuk miyad oshko, to save the abused from one who would abuse him. That's a requirement of the court, to step in on behalf of such a person. So the Talmud in source number 29 gives a case. Without getting into all of the ins and outs of it, there is litigation between two parties. One party wants a debt to have been forgiven, claims that the debt should have been forgiven, and the other party may have had a way around that claim if they had a document called a prosbul. I'm not going into all the ins and outs. But the party who could have had the prosbul didn't say, I had it. So when parties in such a loan came to the sage Rav, he would ask, did you have a prosbul and you just lost it? He's asking the question, inviting them to say yes. And that's an example of the principle, psach picha le'ilem, the court has a responsibility to open its mouth to help those who are mute. Ditto in source number 3 from the Jerusalem Talmud. We discussed this more when we talked about self-represented clients, and I gave you a link there in source number 31, where we discussed the problem of doing this while avoiding favoritism. But the upshot of all of this is that a rabbinical court has one key difference from the secular court in this regard. Much is the same in terms of evaluating incapacity. However, the rabbinical court will have a duty to try to help the party who it deems to be at a disadvantage because of instability, even if they decide that the person is indeed considered to be capable. You follow? I hope that's clear. So I'm going to pause here for a moment and just ask. I'm not going to go through the review questions. I gave you the review questions on the sheet. And I hope that they will be helpful for people to consider. But just questions and comments on that before we move into the tricky boundaries issue. Yes, Miriam. I mean, yeah, no, she interviewed him and accepted him.
Okay, so she knew going into it.
Yes.
At least had the opportunity to make some assessment.
Yes.
Was forced on.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Others before we... Okay, let's do the boundaries discussion. I think the withdrawal thing is going to end up being like a one-line summary. But let's do the boundaries. This is really, really important. So supporting the client's emotional stability is critical. And because we only have about 17 minutes left, I'm not going to make this a discussion. I'm going to speak for a little bit, and then I'll take questions after. From a secular perspective, supporting the client's emotional stability matters because of access to justice. We have a goal. We want society to function in a way that is fair, and people like this deserve the right to have representation. They deserve the ability to be able to speak. I brought you the classic quote from Chief Justice Nathan Nemitz in Source 32. We have no doubt that the right to access to the courts is under the rule of law, one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. So there's a great need to help the emotionally unstable client. We've already noted that an unstable client may be unable to properly make use of the justice system. Their capacity may well become diminished. The judicial proceedings can be a threat to their health. So the lawyer needs to support the client. I also brought you an article in number 33 from Lawyers Weekly. I recognize that Lawyers Weekly articles tend to be more of an advertisement than an article. Nonetheless, I thought the point he made was significant. He writes, this fellow William Teggart, while a lawyer's primary goal may be to serve their clients through recovering compensation, completing a real estate transaction, or drafting wills, today's clients want and deserve more from their law firm. It is no longer enough to simply provide advice and respond to telephone calls, although those are good things to do. Clients want someone who listens and who can empathize, support, and empower them. Today's clients are seeking an emotionally intelligent law firm. And I think that's true, just from people I speak to, certainly, that they are looking for that. They want that from their lawyer. So from a secular perspective, number one, you need to support the emotionally unstable client to ensure they're able to have proper access to the justice system. And number two, clients are looking for this emotional support. Judaism also has the issue of access to justice. I brought you in sources 34 and 35. The obligation to set up judges everywhere in order to make sure that courts will be available, number one. And number two, the principle that you have to strive to make justice available equally. The Torah says there shall be one law for all of you, for the stranger, for the citizen, everybody. And in source number 35, therefore we are told that all matters, financial matters, capital matters, really should require equal attention to the claims of the parties involved. So that you want to make sure this person is going to be able to take advantage of the system. But I'm going to add to that, there is also the personal religious value of taking care of other people, right? The Torah has numerous commands to look out for other people. Lo samot al dam reyecha, do not stand by while someone's blood is shed. If you see somebody's property, that they lost, you have a responsibility to return it, love your neighbor as yourself. I didn't bother bringing all of it on the source sheet. We have obligations to look out for others, both in terms of their physical health and property, and in terms of their mental health. We have laws about onat dvarim, about a person's mental state and making sure you don't speak in a way that's going to damage their mental state. Yesterday's Torah portion, one of the classic lines. Where is the pivot point for Joseph in getting out of his jail, his slavery and jail in Egypt? What's the point where that changes? Yeah, well, but even before that, Joseph is in jail with the butler and the baker, and he wakes up in the morning, and he sees them, Vayaro sam vihinam zo'afim. He sees them, and they are upset, and he says to them, Madua pnechem ra'im hayom. He says, why are you down today? And from that point, he hears the dream, and because he hears the dream, therefore he's able to explain it to them and interpret it. He comes to the attention of the Pharaoh, and he explains the Pharaoh's dream, and so on. Everything rides on seeing that somebody is upset and looking out for them. So the duty of from a Jewish perspective of the lawyer is not only access to justice, but also the personal religious value of taking care of others. So
others.
Were the butler and baker Jewish? We have a duty for everybody. As a general principle, not veering into this too much, but as a general principle in Judaism, we may have greater responsibilities when you're dealing with family or members of the covenant, but you have a universal responsibility of looking after everybody on a basic level. I see the note from Sarah in the chat regarding when a lawyer can withdraw. We're going to get to that, although it's going to be like a one-liner probably. But what does this support look like? So first of all, reducing stress for the client is very, very important. Making sure that you structure your space, you structure your meeting, particularly in the COVID period, even if it's a Zoom meeting, but structuring it in a way that puts them at ease. Listening well, identifying and validating their emotions, not just looking at what's important for the case at hand. Those are really, really important in reducing stress for this person. Communicating. Taking extra steps to communicate points clearly is, I think, crucial. I gave a class for doctors on the problems of informed consent. One of the problems of informed consent is that very often the patient in a medical situation is thrust into a situation they don't understand, under great stress, with a time component to making their decisions. They're completely overwhelmed. That's true in a legal setting as well. So it's really important that you take the time and make the steps necessary to communicate information very clearly and to lay out information and options for the client in a way that takes into account their situation. I gave you a link in source number 36 to a class I gave for doctors regarding cognitive bias in medical decision making. It's very important to recognize that the mentally unstable or emotionally unstable person is going to be biased towards certain ways of thinking. You have to anticipate that and make sure that you speak in a way that's going to be clear and helpful. But while you're giving all of this support to the client, what about the boundary issues? You have lots of boundary issues here. From the client's side, the client has a sense of intimacy that comes with confiding in the lawyer. The client feels a sense of gratitude toward the lawyer. The lawyer may be somebody who is very attractive and charismatic. Like, I can see all the lawyers I see here on the Zoom. I can understand. This poses a real problem. In all seriousness, though, there's a very interesting publication, which I quoted in source number 37. It's called Tempest in the Temple, and it's about concerns for sexual abuse within the synagogue and within the Jewish community. And there's an article in there called Crossing the Line, which highlights in the excerpt that I brought you here one of the problems that you have for rabbis, and I think it's relevant for lawyers. This essay explores the power and perils of rabbinic charisma from an educational perspective. For rabbis to be successful, they need to maintain their own spiritual energy and to mobilize commitment and religious activism in community members. They have to be energetic. They have to be appealing. Regardless of the rabbi's intent, powerful emotions often lead to unpredictable impulses and behaviors. I suggest that the question to pose in the future ought not to be what to do if charged, unexpected, and or erotic feelings develop between rabbi and congregant, but what to do when such feelings occur. You have to anticipate that it's going to happen. And that's true if you are a lawyer who is able to get clients by presenting in a very positive and attractive way, and you talk to them in ways that are appealing, you have to know that this is indeed a risk. There's also an issue, which the psychologist present can discuss better than I can, but I can give you a one-line explanation, of transference, in which the client may transfer to the lawyer their positive feelings for other people who protect them. They have positive feelings, hopefully, towards parents who protected them, maybe towards a spouse, maybe towards a teacher they liked, whatever it was. The lawyer, by becoming their protector, inherits potentially those feelings. Those can create serious boundary problems. But it's also from the lawyer's side, right? Because the lawyer, first of all, wants to keep a paying client. That's something you should remember. That will naturally have positive feelings. The lawyer may have a feeling of affection for the person the lawyer has been helping. And then there's this thing called countertransference, in which if the client is acting towards the lawyer like towards a beloved protector, the result may be that the lawyer responds with the feelings they have towards the people they protect, including, let's say, their children, including potentially their spouse. They will play out those positive feelings towards the client. So what do you do when you're dealing with the emotionally unstable client who you're supposed to protect, right? Because of access to justice, or within Judaism because of the additional layer of religious duty. So what do you do? So I brought you in source number 38, links for a couple of articles that I found useful that you might want to check out. But first of all, I think it's really, really important to set proper boundaries, to ask whom you're willing to represent. Will you represent friends? Will you represent family members? I think that's crucial. I think it's important to clarify how communication will take place. I think that's very, very important. What's the schedule for communication? In what settings is communication appropriate? What are the methods of communicating? To set limits regarding availability. Set expectations for what you're going to discuss in your conversation. Do you make small talk? How much time is appropriate for small talk? And to be predictable and consistent when observing the protocols that you set. And that may mean reiterating the boundaries wherever you need to or in advance of needing to. And there may be blowback. There may be times when that leads to resentment. But it's really, really important to do so, because otherwise you're not communicating a clear message to the client and you can't be surprised when problems come up. In as much as that can help, I think the other side of this is looking out for warning signs in your own conduct. In particular, looking out for the unusual, including altering your normal communication patterns beyond what's necessary to account for their special needs. Meaning, it's possible you have a client who's emotionally unstable. You may need to allow some extra time for them, some extra leeway for them. But know what that is and define it well, and look for, am I going beyond? Giving them unusual leeway in their billing. In general, that may not be a healthy idea for you, but it may signal that there's a problem. Giving them unusual access, drop-in appointments if you're not somebody who normally allows for that. Changing how you dress or act. Today I'm seeing that client, I want to be better dressed. That can be a warning sign. Avoiding calling them on problems in the relationship. Yeah, where with another client you would say something, and with this client you refrain from saying something. Those things, watching for veering from the usual, I think are very important. But I want to add from a Jewish law perspective. The Torah does not explicitly discuss solicitor-client relationships, but it gives a lot of guidance that's very relevant, specifically in the area of potentially romantic relationships. There is a temptation in Jewish law to argue, I'm a professional, I'm doing professional work, I'm not gonna fall into this trap. Right, Moshe Feinstein actually brings that idea regarding doctors and says that a woman can see a male doctor for intimate care with certain precautions, which frankly are common in the general medical world today anyway. But he says one of the reasons to be lenient is because he's a professional. He's dealing with seeing patients, and that's where his mindset is. Nonetheless, it's really important from a Jewish law perspective to take positive steps to set up the right relationship with guidelines for what to expect, as well as to set up the negative boundaries. You know, in Judaism in general, we have an emphasis on coming up with the positive setup as well as the negative. So regarding completely different area, regarding Shabbat, we have Zachor, create an atmosphere of honor for the day, and Shamor, don't do work on that day. Relationships with parents, we have mitzvot of kavod, create a sense of honor for parents, and we also have a mitzvah of morah, of don't act disrespectfully towards parents. So too with a client, we have the positive, set up the rules in advance, set up the boundaries, make sure it's clear and understood and prepare for it. And we also have the negatives. So in Jewish law, we are taught that if a person is prohibited to you, meaning a relationship with them is off limits, then don't be alone together. The prohibition of yichud. Don't engage in affectionate physical contact. That's also prohibited. Now, how a lawyer manages to see a client if you're not supposed to be alone together, there are ways to deal with it. It's beyond the scope of where we're going to go right now with 2 minutes to go. Hang on, Miriam. Sorry. Zoom, right? Potentially. But it's also important to watch out for warning signs. I gave you a source in source number 41 about this, but basically what it means is that Jewish law tends to be more strict if there's a concern that people have become very comfortable with each other, such that they might break boundaries and more easily than others do. There are prohibitions against flirtation. There are requirements of monitoring your thoughts about the other party. All of this becomes part of Judaism's expectations of setting boundaries. Now, I need to know two things just because we're getting towards 11, and I'm going to give you a summary of the withdrawing issue as well. But number one, if you didn't yet put a message to me in the chat with your name to sign in, please do so. Note, I saw some people join very late, and I leave this to you in terms of deciding whether to submit your name or not submit your name. I'm not policing who came in when. This is a legal ethics thing. But that's number one. Number two, though, if you want to be on the email list for these sessions, please also make sure that you submit your name. And if I don't have your email address, as you can tell, if I didn't email you before, that's a sign that you should also send me your email address. Okay. Last point. Withdrawing for practical reasons or personal morality. So the Law Society generally says, and this is just a quick summary, that access to justice overrides the lawyer's duty to self. That's a general principle. You have to worry first about access to justice for the client. It could be Sarah could argue that Jack's phases of non-cooperation may constitute lack of cooperation, and that will fit in source number 42, the argument that the client's not cooperating. That may work. Jack's failure to observe boundaries may create loss of confidence, although usually loss of confidence is defined as the client feeling like or expressing that they're not being represented well. It's their confidence in the lawyer, not the lawyer's confidence in the client. But maybe she can make that argument. It's very clear that if she wants to withdraw, she's going to have to document everything in order to demonstrate the pattern of behavior that has brought her to this point. But also, she can't wait till 3 weeks before trial. That's just not right. If you're having a sense that this relationship is out of control, you can't leave the client 3 weeks before trial. That is the ultimate damage to their access to justice. So from a secular legal perspective, you have to anticipate this need, and you have to document everything and show how their lack of cooperation is undermining the relationship. From a Jewish perspective, access to justice is certainly a powerful reason to stay. What about the fact that I'm supposed to look out for other people? How does that play in? So we have a general principle in Judaism, supported in sources 43 and 44, that says that, yes, you have an obligation to look out for others, however, not at your own expense. Where it becomes self-destructive, your duty ends. So when it comes to tzedakah, there's a mitzvah of giving 10% to support others, a cap of 20%, in order to make sure that you don't bankrupt yourself. Maimonides writes, you're not allowed to solicit philanthropy from somebody who is known to be overly generous to their own detriment. There's much more to be said about this, but my point is, your obligation to help others falls away when it becomes self-destructive. So that will not be a reason to remain. So you can withdraw, but minimize, again, harm to the client. So I realized that I ran through a lot of the end. So I'm going to stay on extra time for people who want to ask questions or make comments. I will stay on extra. But I did want to also ask for a favor for one moment.